So lowering all like veils, it just didn't make sense for me to do business as it was done. Like you were sitting in a meeting for 2 hours, listening to tasks that make no sense and won't move the needle forward on any metric at all. Or maybe they do, but those metrics don't make any sense. That I was like, dude, can we just cut with all of that and do the thing that matters here and just focus on the important stuff that actually makes sense for the company or the client that we're working with?
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in. From the AI Advantage, I'm your host, Solomon Williams. I have a special guest with us today who's going to really touch in deeper inside of the web design and so forth. We have Franco Arza. He's one of the founding members of Darkroom Engineering. So Franco, thanks for coming on to the show, man. You know, I'm really excited about this to learn more about it. Just tell the audience a little bit about like of yourself and then, you know, what is Darkroom?
Sure. Thanks for thinking of us and bringing us in the podcast. I'm Franco. I'm based in Argentina. There's a lot of news about Argentina recently since we had the last president elected. I'm a founding member of Darkroom Engineering. We're a software development studio. We're distributed around the globe. We're doing all kinds of implementations for clients that are usually, we like to call it V1 because there's a tool called V0 that uses AI. And a ton of times our clients are coming from a failed experiment using AI to entirely build their thing. So they just get us to work on their product and build it still using AI, still leveraging that tool, but in a more responsible, safer way, mostly for the users. We're located all over the globe. We have devs in Europe mostly, but also in Latin America.
Got it, man. So I'm curious on it, man. Like, you know, what inspired, because I know we were talking a little bit about like, you know, before on a previous, just of us talking of, you kind of had it to where, like, what inspired you fully to kind of build over with Darkroom? On that. So
there are a couple of things that happened in my career. I've been coding for a bit more than 10 years. I started since I was a kid to tinker with tools and basically Linux and different kind of desktop environments. But doing it professionally, it's been like 10 years since I've been doing like mostly web and web-oriented stuff. And I've been working on different software factories here in Argentina. Those software factories were places where you felt like you were a number and things were not, everything took like 10 steps to get done instead of being direct. So for example, if you wanted to ask for, let's say a chair, you had to raise a ticket, put it in Jira, ask, I don't know, HR, whoever was facilities, whoever was in charge of that area, and it would take around a week for you to get a chair. So all of that time, I don't know, maybe you were expected to sit on the floor. I didn't like that, so I moved into a different place. That was a smaller software factory also here in Argentina. But you didn't feel like a number anymore. It felt way more human. But the thing is that it didn't have the scale of the first company, so the clients were, well, not really exciting. So that led me, but in there is where I met my first co-founder, or the co-founder of the first company that I've started, which was Basement Studio, and the co-founder was Jose. He's currently still driving Basement.studio, and they're doing great. And we decided to basically fix all the problems that we saw in software factories and build something that was a bit more boutique, if you want. We leveraged all the new technologies that we saw, and we really used Twitter to communicate what we were doing. And those tools were basically, back in the day, it was called Zeit and Next.js. On the early versions, it was version, I think, 3 when we started, or 4, something around that. And we decided to just use those tools and deal with any shortcomings that we may have because of using those bleeding edge technologies. And at the time, it meant, I don't know, deploying the whole server again because something changed in the new version and everything got broken or stuff like that. But we were okay with dealing with all of that. Yeah. That was the first version or the first studio. From there, we met Guillermo Rauch, Vercel's CEO. he reached out on Twitter and we started collaborating with them from a marketing point of view, which led us to getting a lot more leads that were SaaS companies that wanted basically something similar to what Vercel had for themselves. So business was good. We built a ton of networking, and that led us to collaborating with a team from the US called Studio Freight. That team is was a design studio from Ohio, from Columbus. And they, at one point, they wanted to like hire us and work only with Basement. And then they made me an offer to join them as a partner. That's what I did. When I joined them as a partner, I spent there like 3 years. And I was in charge of building the whole development team there. And yeah, after 3 years, that development team had grown to being like five, including me. And we were called like Studio Freight's darkroom because it's where things get developed in there. And yeah, after 3 years, we decided to, we feared that we needed a bit more autonomy and we wanted to build things, more open source stuff and build more of our libraries. You can see on GitHub, we have a ton of published libraries or public repositories for libraries, basically building the tools that we feel everyone needs and no one is actually building or putting out there. So we're just doing that. And sometimes those are extremely like low-level tools, like, I don't know, a full scroll library or a collection of hooks for React and stuff like that, or maybe a request animation frame handler or something like that, like super, super niche, but are things that we kept like reinventing on every project. It was here, oh, let's just build a library and fix it once and for all. And so that's where Darkroom came to be. And we started Darkroom in February 2024. And since then, we've been still collaborating with Studio Freight. We're also friends with the Basement guys, of course, and also still using Vercel for most of our tasks. And also leaning on their AI offering and all the tools that they've made available to build apps, not only using AI like while you're building, but also to integrate AI in your products.
And, you know, because I think you touched on a really good point that I think like a lot of, especially engineers, and especially I can imagine for the web developer side of it, you get so much into the the approach of the project management style of backlogs, of having to go through getting approval with QA. And there's so much of, as you said, like about building the chair, right? There's so many steps that get involved into, as you said, what is the client supposed to do? Just sit on the floor, you know, but as you kind of learned from that and kind of saw the cons of that, when you came in with Darkroom, and you know, I know Darkroom emphasizes like the no middle managers, you know, how do you structure the projects and the responsibilities of like, you know, when we get these more deeper, you know, more complex deliveries, how do you make sure that that framework is still there, but you're still giving that autonomy to the developers? Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes total sense. It's tricky, but the reason why it's tricky, it's not because it's a hard thing to do. It's because it's so much easier than most people think, but it requires a bit of courage, if you want, and being able to trust the people that you bring on board. We actually, and I have it laying around here, we have a book that has basically a condensation of all the things that made us build Darkroom and that led us to think why Darkroom is different. It's a bit because we trust the people that join us and we start from trust. And those are concepts that I've been collecting from different books. And that's the thing that it's condensed here. Instead of me explaining everyone what each book said or giving the team members the books for them to read on their time, I would just give them this and give this a read. And basically what I added here are the concepts from Frederick Lew's Reinventing Organizations. In that book, he's categorizing organizations in different colors, and those colors are based on, those categories are based on how those organizations treat their members. And the last, the more evolved type of organization there is this teal color, which is basically everyone trusts each other. And when you join a company that it's teal coded or in this teal organization, in this teal type of companies, according to Frederick Lew, it means that company trusts you to be a full developed human being that got to their 20s or 30s or whatever age you are by yourself, and you're responsible for the things that you're doing. So having ownership on the tasks, making sure everyone knows the consequences and knows that things have consequences, and make it easier for them to decide whether they want to do something or not, and the consequences that that task is going to have. It's tricky to scale, maybe, because you have to have extremely high trust in the people that join the team. So we put a ton of effort in that part of the process, the interviewing, the cultural alignment, basically the common sense that people brings to the team is the most important thing that I look for in team members to join. Is that answer your question?
Look, no, absolutely. You know, so because I really like that. I feel like even especially when starting up and when you're on this leadership side, you know, obviously you're looking at the bottom line, the outcome of like how can we effectively provide more value to our partners and everything. But at the same time, I really like your approach to it as well as looking on internally, how of our team, you know, being able to really empower them, give them the autonomy, and then making sure that they feel like they're an integral part without having to get into the whole bureaucracy of that. So did that, you know, for that leadership style of that, and did you learn that over the previous beforehand? Did that just come through with the book as you were mentioning? I'm curious to have it to where did that, you know, leadership side, that mindset come into play?
So lowering all like veils, it just didn't make sense for me to do business as it was done. Like you were sitting in a meeting for 2 hours, listening to tasks that make no sense and won't move the needle forward on any metric at all. Or maybe they do, but those metrics don't make any sense. I was like, dude, can we just cut with all of that and do the thing that matters here and just focus on the important stuff that actually makes sense for the company or the client that we're working with? If it's a branding and we're spending 2 or 3 days talking about a 4 or 6 pixel border radius, dude, it doesn't matter. And people are probably going to kill me for this because I'm also design savvy and I care about those details. But it depends. There's a time and a place to care about those details. And sometimes if you have a product that you want to launch and you want to look for product market fit or something like that, it doesn't really matter how good or bad your design is. It can make or break a product, but if you're just trying a concept, just go ahead and do it, put it out there, start getting feedback as soon as possible and iterate on what you have. So regarding the management style, it kind of came to be from this nonsense that I had to deal with in the past. I like not having a chair. I can't be productive. I'm not making money for you as my employer because I don't have a chair. And it would be super cheap for you to just give me a chair and I can bring a ton more value. But it's, I could not believe that this common sense that I had and this sudden realization did never happen to my employers back in the day. And I felt like, well, can we just try it and build something from scratch? Which is what we did. And it started back then in basement, and then a bit of that transpired to Studio Freight. I had more partners there. So my vote was basically 25% instead of 50. And now here at Darkroom, it's different because we're all aligned into that. The thing that we want to build has to enhance the style of living that we all want to have. And it's not just the management level or like what you would typically call the C level of the company, but also the whole company as a structure. Everyone is aware of the thing that they're bringing. No one is basically ashamed of asking questions and feeling like, oh, I don't know, someone is going to think that I don't deserve the paycheck that I have or the seniority that I have or whatever. Because we all know that we have to build those places of trust. And we all have like a saying in those places, and we all have a responsibility towards those places. And building them, it's all of Darkroom's responsibility, not just me as a founding member or like a junior dev that joined or someone in HR. And that's why we can't afford to reduce so much the management layer, because everyone self-manages themselves. Everyone is capable enough and everyone feels safe enough to say things directly in the channels. And if there's any, for example, we use Slack We try to manage most of the projects there. And it's basically your project management tool. Even QA is done in boards, in Kanban boards inside Slack. And we leverage all the AI power or automations that we can from that tool. And if, I don't know, I'm not assigned to a project, but I see the client is complaining about border radius, which is a simple task, and they're consistently complaining about something that they look and seems off to them. Why would I wait for the whole team to review that when, I don't know, maybe it's they're off already because of different time zones, or they're dealing with something that is way more important, and that's something that is important to the client, but it's not important for the app itself because it's not a backend or an API or whatever. So I can just jump in, fix it, and that's it. It's done. No one will ever complain again about that because it's done. So just tackle whatever task instead of scheduling a call, getting there, learning the details about the problem with the border radius or whatever it is. I don't care about all that. You just told what the problem was on Slack, and I have all the context. I have access to the code base. I have access to the continuous deployment platform. I can just make it happen. And it will take like 5 minutes from my life, and you will be a happy client without all of that bureaucracy. And what we've seen across the projects is that after the clients get a taste of this way of dealing with stuff, they can go back to the usual like agency model where everything has to be planned for and everything has to be a part of a roadmap and a timeline and a schedule and has to be put in the queue, blah, blah, blah. Because they're like, dude, it's simple. Just change it from red to green or whatever. And yeah, we're just doing that. And it's common sense. But again, people just got used to overcomplicating all of this and thinking that everything is more important than it actually is. It's just a button, you change it, try it. And I've seen that happen a ton on X, for example. They're breaking the platform, fixing it live in front of our eyes. Which, in my opinion, is something amazing to see happen because you can see something as big as Twitter with the amount of users and all the seriousness that that app should have. They're constantly breaking things in production and they are like, yeah, it's not that important. You can change the logo, you can change the name, and the platform will continue to behave, to work, because there are other things that are more important than, I don't know, maybe the marketing of it.
You know, and you touched on a lot of good things that I kind of see even, you know, just as, you know, speaking with other founders, it makes sense because there's so many things that get involved, even for myself, speaking of it, of, as you said, there's the things that you're doing are not moving the needle forward, right? And you get so caught up, there's so many tasks. And sometimes, as you've said, we've become so accustomed. Probably because of the scale of it, or maybe it's because we want to kind of go through a certain, you know, workflow of, you know, if we're following through on Agile or Scrum, you have to go through, you know, stand up, then you got to go through a discovery, you got to go through breakdown of how much each task or each, you know, user story, what the point. And as you've said, it goes so further along to, if there's just an issue, let me just get that done. So my question, you know, I'm curious on your thoughts on it, having it as companies kind of like scale and, you know, from your experience of working with, because the whole thing of what I'm finding from what I'm understanding with you is finding the right people that you trust, right? And that's the key part. It comes all the way, always back down to, it's not the technology, it's the people that you employ, that you work with, your team. So from your side, as you scale, as Darkroom continues to scale and, you know, continues to move upwards, you know, what would you suggest to like other SaaS or any of, you know, for these startups on how to maneuver and taking these points of what you had and what they can do for their business?
So to make it extremely clear on what I mean with this, of like trusting the people that joins the team, I have this like a test that I do internally. I don't even say this to the devs trying to join us or anyone trying to join us. But like, for example, would you trust your wallet to me? Would you give your wallet to me? You wouldn't. Not right now. We don't know each other that much. It's all good. Like, it makes sense. It's common sense. Again, well, I can say 100% sure that I would give my wallet to any of the team members on Darkroom. And I would even ask them to manage it for me for a whole month. And they will always think of what's best for me given the resources that they have available. I can trust each one of our team members that way. And we actually do, because everyone has access to our bank accounts, and they can manage the assets of the company and know that, for example, if we have to hire a freelancer to get something done, and they know the budget for a freelancer, they're the ones like making all the negotiations needed, etc., because they need something done. And they know, I don't know, it's X amount of money. If they feel like that amount of money is best put in that thing that they are trying to do, whether it's a freelancer or internal project or whatever, we all trust them that they're doing it for the better of the company. And they know that if they start like using up all the company's resources and dumb frivolous things, there's no company left for anyone else. They're aware of that. And they are being kept aware of that by sharing the metrics and the spreadsheets with them. Not that they care as much, but basically there's someone taking care of that who's all the time with their eyes on that and making sure like, no subscriptions are unused, and making sure like everything that we are actually paying for makes sense for us to keep paying for. But that's basically the test that I do, is like, would I trust my wallet to this person? If the answer is no, then I would rethink if that person should be part of our team. If my answer, usually an instant yes, but that's after all the interview period. So what I would suggest is basically keeping teams small, keeping teams communicating with each other directly, keep all the conversations in general public channels. Obviously, you can use different like channels to stay on topic, but making the information available for everyone. Because, for example, if I'm joining on a call with you to talk about a specific technical issue, all the knowledge that was generated out of that meeting only lives in my head and in yours. That's it. But if you, after that, let's say a call is needed because it's easier to just talk about it and riff. But after a call, we have to do a brief on a general challenge and share what we discovered, so everyone now can basically add that knowledge to theirs as well. And then we can focus on different problems. Otherwise, everyone on the team feels like it's dealing with the same thing at different times. We would like to avoid that. And that's done by using the general channels. And again, it kind of feels like everything, like nothing makes sense, but everything is connected, because this level of trust that allows people to ask even dumb questions in public channels is what also allows them to share, basically feel like having conversations with themselves on those open spaces. But that allows you to pick everyone's brains and know, oh, this is what X is doing or Y is doing, or the reasons why they came to this solution instead of another thing that I would have done if I was in their shoes. So that gives you context, and context in it got pretty relevant recently with all the AI and all that. But context is the most important thing that you can give someone else that you're collaborating on something.
And, you know, I think that's the main goal of what we're anyone, especially, is having the trust in your team to be able to move forward, that everyone's aware of it. And then, especially with the use of AI now, it's able to, you know, now it's able to employ or enable you to not do a lot of the busy work. It's able to tab your team members' work and produce and, you know, now brainstorm, think of how can I improve the process? How can I improve the company and so forth now? So I think that's the goal of each of what you and what your team is moving forward on and trailblazing on in terms of that culture. I would love to have that. You know, that's the goal, I think, for any side. So I you know, I'm curious, now that you have this, you've kind of established this perfect, you know, scenario of having it to where your team really works well. What are your thoughts on, like, what are you seeing in terms of the shifts now on the web development side and as you go forward? Because you've already figured out your customers really like this process of, if there's a bug, fix. And now with Twitter, as you mentioned, like, you're seeing constantly in production, they're constantly fixing. Well, not constantly, but, you know, they're showcasing that they're improving upon it and so forth. What are you seeing that are on the challenges for the industry moving forward? And what are the big shifts now, especially with the AI side?
So I think a couple of like low code and O code tools like Framer or Webflow or others are integrating AI and making it easier for you to build a whole, like a stuff that it's way more complex than just the landing page with them. So I think that's going to be way more prominent, and also making AI more central to the process. Right now, it's more like an aid, more like a bit of help on the side that does maybe the grunt work and all the like tasks. But I think it's going to be way more central. It's going to allow for things. And this is similar to what happened back in when I started using Vercel. They were taking so much time off my shoulders that they allowed me to focus on what was important for me. So things that used to take a week, for example, back in the day, now take a day. So the other 5 days of the week, I can do so much on top of the stuff. I can learn more stuff. I can bring more attention to the detail of the thing that I'm trying to put live. Since that happened, that allowed me to build better products, build more complex things, and also do more things being less people. We were used to, in the first software factory, we were like 2,000 employees. The second one, there was like 150 or 70. And the first company that I've co-founded, we were two. And we were rivaling them. We were building things at the same pace as those companies were. Not the same complexity, because they were building larger apps and they had more skills at their disposal, because, like, I don't know, they had specific people for backend and specific people for front end, specific designers for the UX process or the UI process or whatever it's needed. And we were just two guys. So I had to be a full stack dev, and the other guy has to be a full stack designer, sometimes doing motion, branding, whatever needed. But AI is doing the same thing all over again. So we're bringing AI into the process, and we're trying to see where it fits. When we started by basically thinking, okay, if this is a hammer, everything is a nail, let's just use it for everything. And now I feel like we're starting to understand, not sure of the limits, because things are still evolving quite rapidly, but maybe knowing where it fits best in our process, and maybe bringing it more closer to the center instead of the sides, and making, rethinking how we use the different tools that we use now that they are enhanced by this basically ear interned and that's AI.
I think it's amazing that just you and your founders, exactly as you said, that you have to worry about all of these other portions of it, as building a business with marketing, branding, all that, but you're still able to compete, even, as you said, maybe not on the complexity and maybe not as to the bandwidth of these larger companies, but with the help of these tools and just with your co-founder, just you and him, are able to do so much, you know, with in competing against these larger corporations. And I think that's the, do you think that's the divide now with the emergence of AI, utilizing it now, that it's going to make it more of a level playing field? Or do you think it's still, as we go forward, there's still going to be some discrepancies?
So back in the day, and this is, I think, what's best about AI, is that it removes any fears. Or at least that's what happened to me when I started using it. I'm not afraid of saying yes to something that I'm not capable of doing, because I know I can find a way, because there are tools that are going to teach me how to do it with all the patience in the world, using the right analogies, using the right parallels between the stack that I'm an advanced user, and this, the things that I'm just learning now. Where it's like, I don't know, front end going to back end, the back end going to front end going to design, design going to dev. It doesn't really matter, but since that fear is being diminished by AI and having access to this tutor all the time, I feel like it's easier for anyone to try more things and to do more stuff and just dive into it and try things. I love it. And it's something similar that happened back in the day when we were just starting with Next.js. What I felt that it was great about that framework is that it doesn't really matter if you were building a landing page, a marketing website, or a full-blown app, because it could scale. You were building both, and it was not adding complexity to your process. So you could just, like, we'll figure how big this becomes in the future. But for now, we don't have to spend time thinking about architectural problems. You can just use Next.js, and then that will scale, whether you need it to be like a Gmail or whatever app, or just a landing page with WebGL and crazy 3D effects. You can build both with the same tool. So the same thing is happening here. Like, I was not afraid of saying yes to an app, to a WebGL website. The same thing is happening now with AI. I'm not afraid of doing stuff that are a bit out of my comfort zone because I know I can find the right analogies and parallels between the stack that I am fully aware of and the things that are new to me.
And, you know, it's even crazy now because I know it, even with, I know it's in the beta stage, you build Gemini and, you know, with all the other kind of leading AI sites that now, as you were mentioning, now, you know, beforehand, and we're seeing iterative processes now. First, it was Googling or YouTube University where you have to kind of get up to speed on what you may be missing. But now AI has the side of where I was mentioning before, 3D now, and a learning mode and everything else where it can help you to learn and build and skill. So now you're not taking that additional time. Now it's removing, as you said before, I think of it in terms of maybe as a martial artist or a boxer, you're taking out those unnecessary movements and now it's just lean. It's cutting straight forward. You're going through these simple angles and you're cutting off the fluff of that, unnecessary movement, right?
Yep. That's exactly how we see it. And that's the core reason why Darkroom exists, cutting the fluff everywhere, not only, but rethinking everything from first principles. Why are we using Jira? Because we just got used to it. Do we still need it today? Why are we using the Scrum methodologies or Agile or whatever? Doesn't it still make sense now? Why do we think we need a PM on the team? Do we actually need them? Or maybe we need more like an orchestrator that deals with agents and people and just orchestrates the workload between them? Well, there are all of these things happening internally and we're having an extremely hard time trying to put a name on each other's roles because we really don't have one. I'm a dev, but I'm also doing sales. I'm also doing design sometimes. I'm using Midjourney to generate assets that I can provide a designer and they can get an idea, a way better idea, like a visual idea on or a visual representation on what my ideas were for something that we were talking about. Sometimes it's client work or internal stuff, but all of these tools are making everyone lose their fear of failing, in my opinion, because it's so easy to try something and, oh, I don't like the results, just throw it away. But it took 5 minutes. It's not that you have to hire someone to do something for you, spend a couple of thousands, and then you don't like it, and you're like, oh, I wasted a couple thousand. You just pay $20, use Midjourney, ChatGPT, Gemini, whatever it is, and throw it away if you don't like it. It was just $20.
Exactly. So do you think like as Darkroom's continuing to scale and, your vision on it, do you think what is the bottleneck, would you say, being more just having, because you're having to wear multiple different hats, is it to kind of take away those hats to where you can focus specifically on what you like, whether that's on the design side or scaling a company? What would you say is the challenge or the bottleneck now that, whether that's with the workflow or whether it's scaling the business, what would you say?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things, actually. The first one is, in my opinion, the stability, basically. Getting a flow of projects and work that we feel comfortable because we kept growing the team. We started 1 year ago when we were 4 and now we're 10 after 1 year. So that gave us a ton of new skills, but also we haven't reached the limits of the team yet. So we don't know what our metrics are because it just kept growing as needed. So I'm thinking about stabilizing it. It's one thing. This is the first thing that I can think of. And then also it may be about it's related to this stability thing, but also thinking about writing all the processes down and making sure they are somehow standardized given this all this new knowledge that we've gathered on how we're doing things internally and be able to share those things easier between each other when someone new joins the team. Right now, it's feels a bit chaotic for someone new to join because everyone is doing everything everywhere all at once. And they're like, okay, what should I do? And well, pick whatever you want and just do it. And it's hard for those people to join us and be productive quick. And sometimes it's hard on them because they feel like, oh, they're going to think that I'm lazy or I'm not doing enough and they don't really know because we don't have a clear career path and all of those more traditional things yet. Maybe at some point, but we have to first figure what does a career path look like at Darkroom? Not just get whatever else, whatever everyone else is doing and apply that. We don't want to do that. So I would say like maybe standardizing, formalizing the process, stabilizing the company a bit instead of being so chaotic. And there's one more thing that I was thinking of when I started rambling about standardizing that I now lost. So
that's good. I think, man, like, because even with me, I think you're not alone into this part. And even myself, even Solinox has just been, even with when I've worked with enterprises, larger enterprises, it's, you'd be surprised on how, you know, it's sometimes you see it's a lot of tribal knowledge where there is not a structured flow. You'd be very surprised whether it's within your repo, within Confluence, whatever it is that you have for your documentational SharePoint. You'd be surprised on, you know, when someone comes on, there isn't a proper onboarding side, you know, just because you get, there's so many things to get onto of having to figure out on how to help, you know, your, these new people come on. So I think you're not alone. Like even for myself, that happens, but I'm glad that at least you're conscious of that and you're putting this in, I'm sure, as you kind of iterate more. So that leads me into like on this side, like where, you know, as Darkroom's growing and, you know, getting these side, you know, where do you want to see, where's your vision of it to be in the next either 6 months from now or even from here next year? Is it more tooling? Is it more of the bigger projects? Is it making sure the team is lean enough and the a standardized process? Like, I'm curious to see what your vision of Darkroom is.
I'm thinking about slowing down a bit on the hiring part and solidifying the team that we currently have, sharing a bit more knowledge horizontally. Right now, it feels like everyone is on their lane, specializing on one skill set. I feel like we could share way more. But I'm thinking more about like how we want to build for... So we're a services studio. We provide a service. We do design and development for others. But we build a ton of libraries, and we're trying. One of the reasons why we broke out and started Darkroom as a standalone thing was to try and see if open source could be profitable. We're failing. We're proving that it's not. It's extremely hard to make it profitable by itself, but just doing the libraries. You also have to market them. You also have to do design for them. So you have to invest in them. And obviously, like, we're just doing it because those are tools for a niche, which is us. So we were thinking about how can we subsidize the libraries with maybe, I don't know, Framer components, for example. So we build a Framer component that it's $10 and it's using all the open source libraries under the hood. So that's the way that we can, for example, if you want the plug and play version, you just pay $10. If you want to build it yourself, you still can because everything is open source. But you have to do the manual work. You have to basically lay all the cables and connect everything yourself. If you're okay with that, then it's free. Just do it. But if you don't want to do that, pay $10 and get the off-the-shelf component. So we've been doing that. We're going to be doing more of that and try to build a comprehensive suite of components based on all of our libraries and based on all of these pain points that we've identified, both on the tools and also on the people using the tools. Like the tools sometimes have cumbersome ways of doing things that we feel like we could simplify, being on both sides of the desk. Yeah. And also the designers are, I don't know, looking for an easier way to deal with animations and interactions. And we've done so many of them in the last 10 years that it's just second nature. So basically the midterm and maybe long-term as well, goal for the studio is build the tools that then we call it design technician, which is a new role that we are calling internally for now, which is this designer who's building the project. Because, and I'm kind of rambling, I'm all over the place, but let me try to formulate this in a way that makes sense. So our devs in the midterm are probably going to be building tools instead of websites, and then someone else is going to use those tools to build the websites. So that's what we call a design technician, because it's not a designer that is just painting a picture in a canvas. It's a designer that's actually building the thing And every time they hit a roadblock, there's a dev that can lift it for them so they can build a website. We're leveraging tools like, well, Framer, as mentioned. We're doing a ton of experiments in Framer, trying to build all of these components that are Lego blocks that then the designer can use to build a website. That's one thing, but on the custom side, when we build websites from scratch, we use Theater.js, which is a tool that, an easy way to put it, is basically, what's the video editor? The Adobe video editor? Well, whatever, any video editor that you can work with timelines and sync the audio, all of that, you can do all of that in the browser. So Theater.js, we just wire everything for the designer and then let the designer build a website, even 3D, like placing 3D elements in a scene and doing stuff like that. They are the ones doing it. We just tell the UI what should each button do. Like, this place is a square, this place is a rectangle, this place is a, I don't know, duodecahedron, whatever it is, in this scene. And then they can move them around, similar to working on Blender, but they're actually working on the website itself. So that's the thing that we want to be doing more, building the tools for the designers to build the websites instead of being ourselves building the websites over and over again.
Yeah, I think it comes on to, I think I even saw like some of your journey on building out Revelo. I think it was the scroll-based animation. You're now coming up with different animations for, is that right? Kind of utilizing that framer. Is a little bit about it?
Well, yes. Revelo, it's the first test that we did. It's using it's leveraging Lenny's the Smooth Scroll library to be able to sync the animations. So it's one like low-hanging fruit that we saw on Framer, that no one was doing it correctly. Like, everything was too cumbersome. No one was getting it like right. And the designers were kind of like needing that. There was an appetite for text animations and websites. So we just tried it. It's using a ton of our open source libraries, but it's sold for $10 because we are starting to subsidize the work that we're doing on open source with these components. So Revelo is the first one, but we're thinking about others in the near future. They are going to be probably similarly priced and similar in the amount of functionality, because we want to keep them focused on doing like one thing, but doing it right. It's going to be you're going to see way more Legos being deployed. And we're thinking that like Framer has been a great partner and a great platform to build on top of. So we're going to probably be doing it more and more in there instead of trying different platforms.
Yeah, and I really like that I always value the open source approach because it's giving it back. Obviously, you need to kind of put it, you have the option of plug in where, you know, putting in the business model of it, of course, to have it be done for. But I've always appreciated the open because that helps to move the community upwards and helping to be able to have folks look deeper. So, you know, of the time and everything else, because I could go on and, you know, I'm really enjoying this conversation about this. You know, so before I let you go, Frank, what is it now with keeping this in mind? You're seeing how the industry is moving and so forth else. What do you, if you had this magic wand on in terms of like AI, if you're seeing that it's helping your team, you're looking more stabilized now, like if the next ChatGPT 9, 10, you know, or whether it's your day-to-day life or with the business itself, what would you like AI to do, you know, moving forward?
That's a good one. I think everything I do, so I can just retire.
Right.
Just clone me and send that back to work.
Right.
No, I mean, I do love what I do, so I would hate that to happen. But I think like there's a ton of small tasks that I still have to handle that I wish like disappeared from my to-do list. A lot of that deal is like basically, I don't know, small, tiny management stuff. But thinking a bit more, I've been thinking a lot about the UI that we have to access large language models. And right now we have a chat interface, the best that we could come up with, which reminds me all the time of what the DOS era of computing was. When you were working on a terminal using the software, the operative system in a terminal, you had to learn all of these commands, and you always had this tiny keyhole view on what was possible with a computer. I keep having thoughts about, like, that's where we are right now with AI. We don't have the right UI to interact with. I have no idea what that is. I've been thinking about it, but I think it has to be embedded at an OS level and make the computer actually work for you. So instead of I'm opening apps, I just tell the computer to do stuff and I don't care about the apps it's using behind the scenes or what it has to do behind the scenes. And I can go on the internet as you would go in a museum. You can go if you want, but you can also watch a movie in Netflix or see a picture of art. I know it's not the same, but you can interact with the same things different ways. If you just want to know what the Mona Lisa looks like, you can look for a picture online. If you want to go to the Louvre and see it in real life, you can also do that. That's what I feel like should happen at some point. And if you ask me, if I had a magic wand and I could have something specific solved by AI, I think it's all the management tasks, from dealing with the contracts and getting everything signed to connecting that with the bank and sending all the invoice information to, like, doing all of that meaningless work that it's important because, I mean, someone has to do it. The client needs to get the invoicing details and you have to receive the money for the work that you're doing. But I couldn't care less about doing that. That it's not adding any value to the process or any value to the client to spend time doing that. So if I could reduce the amount of time that needs to be spent doing that, I think that's the first thing I would do.
I think being like, it goes back to that true executive. It says Jarvis, like if you think of Iron Man, you're really kind of hoping to do that.
It's always fall in that category. Yeah. But yeah.
I love it, man. I'm glad that you came on and so forth, frankly, for taking this on. As you, especially with Darkroom, as you guys are scaling up and you're, especially with you having to wear multiple hats as an entrepreneur in the visionary. You know, before I let you, like, where can people go to like learn more about Darkroom and kind of understand, like, if there's a need that they feel, like, how, what can Darkroom do for them? And then if they wanted to follow you more just on your channel, LinkedIn, where can they find you?
So I would say, like, mostly on Twitter. We are most active there. Darkroom Devs at Twitter or Arsafran, which is my handle at Twitter. We tried LinkedIn, but we just suck at it. So we stopped trying. And Twitter feels more natural to us because we're just ourselves in any platform or in any format. So it's hard for us to adhere to those, like, I don't know, protocols that happen on LinkedIn or other social networks that are not Twitter. Twitter feels a bit more raw and you can just be yourself. And you can fail easier. So that's basically what Darkroom is all about. Fail as soon and as cheap as possible. So when things are complex and expensive, you have all of that figured out.
Again, appreciate you coming on. For those listening, you can, you know, follow more on Twitter, as Franco mentioned, to be able to get more insight and be able to look through on the website of Darkroom. You can see that show notes for that. So thanks for listening in to the full episode. If you did, make sure to, you know, like and subscribe and, you know, follow us for more. Check us out next week on our next episode. So thanks for staying tuned to the AI Advantage, everyone.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a day.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more no fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at solonox.net.